There's been three stages in my Christian life. The first one was that I came to understand that Jesus was God, that he was the Messiah. The second stage was me setting out with everything I had to try and be a good person. The third stage was understanding that indeed I am not a good person. It was only then that I came to understand God's love, his mercy, God's grace.
Welcome to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center. Our hosts are Dr. Jack Crabtree and Christine Barber. Jack is a philosopher by training, but his real passion is the Bible, having studied and taught it for more than 25 years. He is currently on staff at Mackenzie Study Center and Gutenberg College in Eugene, Oregon. Christine is a licensed marriage and family therapist, having practiced in California and Oregon for over 20 years. She is employed by the Caris Foundation, a teaching and counseling ministry. In this series, titled Being a Christian, Jack and Christine discuss the most important biblical concepts of the Christian life. Now, here are Jack and Christine.
This weekend, one of my boys had two friends over to spend the night. And the next morning, I was out gardening, and right in front of my son's window, I saw some broken flowers and some dirt on the windowsill. About an hour later, I got a call from somebody, and they said that my son and a couple of other kids had toilet papered their house. So I kind of started the weekend with that. Last night, one of the mothers who my son had toilet papered, her son had toilet papered my son, called me and was talking to me about it, and she said, "You ought to know what to do. After all, you're a counselor." I just hate it when people tell me that. Because, you know, Jack, it seems like there are some things that I really know how to work with, and there are other things I really don't. But generally speaking, it really feels to me like I am simply trying my best, goofing up all the time, muddling through life. And I really have this sense that apart from God just giving me faith, just giving me life, I would just be lost.
Yeah. Yeah, that is life, and that's just the nature of the human situation that we're in. There's really two things that contribute to that. One is that we're finite. Even if we were morally perfect beings, we're limited in our knowledge, we're limited in our perspective, we're just not God. You know, we're not in a position to know all and to be all and to do all. So our finiteness itself limits us severely. But above and beyond our finiteness, what the Bible teaches is that we are sinful, that we have this warped perspective because of our inherent selfishness and perversity and hostility toward God that just warps everything that we think and say and do and see. So, you know, those are pretty huge liabilities. I mean, it shouldn't come as a surprise to anybody that we have to kind of bumble our way through life, given the nature of our situation.
But I think it really does come as a surprise to most of us. I mean, it ought not. I think the Bible, our theology, tells us this, that we're sinners and that we're fallen and that we're bumblers. But you know, I think on the other hand, we really like to think better of ourselves than we are. Mm-hmm. And so we kind of get knocked up against the wall with all sorts of things in life. And it's like, wow.
Right. And that's probably, you know, we've been talking about sanctification. That's probably one of the most important aspects of sanctification, is that willingness to accept the truth about ourselves, that we are broken, that we are fallible, that we are unworthy, that we're really not nearly as good and as hot as we think that we are. And that's a very, very hard pill to swallow. But it's the people who can swallow that pill and face into the truth of that head on that that show the work of God sanctifying them. I mean, it's not the only thing our sanctification consists of, but it's a really, really important indicator that we are being sanctified as children of God.
Yeah, it seems like one of the key ones, Jack, that I would recognize that I really am a sinner and see that really clearly. I was talking to a friend or not really a friend, an acquaintance, a couple of days ago, and they had heard me talk about something on the radio that was really astonishing to them, that I would have done that kind of thing. And they said that for a number of months now, they've been very, very upset with me because they really had thought better of me than that and were really very, very disappointed in me and had only just now come to start thinking that it was okay to connect with me again, but wondering about my faith or my belief and about my character and seeing themselves as not having a character nearly as bad as mine. And what I said to them, and yet they said they really wanted to pursue God in their life, and what I said to them was, yes, I don't like some of these characteristics of myself. I don't like them at all. I wish they were gone. But the fact is, we have the same heart, and given the same circumstances, that person would do what I did. All of us would hurt other people given the same context, same situation, and that I hope that God brings them to a place of understanding that they're not different than I am. And that's a radical thing. And they said, well, how will I get there? Why don't you just tell me? And I said, I am right now, but you're not believing me. And what God has to do is bring us through very humbling experiences to teach us who we are at the core of our being.
And that just is the process of sanctification. That process that God takes us through in life, where life really beats up on us in a lot of ways. And as we get beaten up, you know, one of two things happen. We grow bitter and cynical and more resentful of God and hateful toward Him. Actually, probably one of three things happens. Or we just get numb and seek in every possible way to just distract ourselves and not think about anything. Or we come to terms with, who am I really? Who is God? Who am I in relationship to God? And we actually learn to be wise. And it's the people who choose wisdom out of the beating up that life gives that are the people that are being sanctified, are being shown to be marked off to be children of God.
And in this context, you're using wisdom to mean people who really are willing to look at an accurate picture of themselves.
Themselves, God.
The world.
The world, everything. Yeah, others. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So today we wanted to talk about faith and justification. Can we use this as a lead into those things?
Well, I don't know. but let me just explain what I think the problem is. If I were listening to us talk 10 years ago, maybe even 5 years ago, my objection to everything that we've been saying over the past several weeks would be, whoa, wait a minute, you guys. I thought that justification was by faith. And you seem to be saying that justification is by this thing you're calling sanctification, and you're defining sanctification as all sorts of different qualities that are being manifested out of a person's heart and character and spirit and so on. That sounds to me like justification by works. So what gives? Are we justified? Are you guys rejecting the whole tradition of justification by faith in what you're saying? That would be the objection that I would raise. And so I think it would be well for us to kind of address that and try to sort out the issues involved there.
So are we justified by works, or are we justified by faith?
My short answer is we are justified. My short answer is the answer that James gives. We're justified by works working along with our faith.
So faith and works working together.
Yeah, that there really is no conflict in the New Testament's view of things. If we understand what we mean by works correctly, then we can say we are justified by works, or we can say we are justified by faith, and we mean the same thing. We're pointing to the same reality. Now, I have to explain why that's true. I haven't done that yet. But mostly, when we talk about justification by faith, we're thinking not in terms of the book of James, but we're thinking in terms of the books of Romans and Galatians in the New Testament, where Paul argues that we are justified by faith and not by works of the law. But it's critical that we understand that Paul is arguing not that we're justified by faith rather than by works, what he's saying is we're justified by faith rather than works of the law. And that of the law is critical to understand what Paul is talking about there.
So the key here is really understanding what works of the law mean.
I think so. Right.
And when we understand what these works really are, then we'll understand James' statement that works and faith are working together.
Right. Right. So let's do that. Let's talk a little bit first about what Paul means, what he's combating, what he's arguing against.
When Paul is talking about works of the faith?
Works of the law. Yeah.
So those are in the books of Galatians and Romans.
Right. Right. Paul is responding to, in Romans, a group of non-believing Jews answering objections that they have to this newfangled teaching that the rabbi Paul is importing into Rome. And in Galatians, he's speaking to believers. They are, in fact, believers in the sense that they are willing to acknowledge and profess Jesus to be the Messiah. So they're believing Christians in the sense that they have accepted Jesus. But they're not at all convinced that anybody can become justified in God's eyes unless they're Jewish. So Gentiles cannot be justified in God's eyes. They need to first convert to Judaism and become a practicing Jew. And then, in the context of their practicing Judaism, if they believe that Jesus is the Messiah, then of course they're justified and saved along with anyone else. They're qualified to receive the blessing of Abraham. But their perspective is that only Jews really can receive that blessing. So they're slightly different audiences and slightly different questions, but the problem with both points of view is fundamentally the same as Paul sees it. The problem is that within the context of Judaism, and Paul, we have to remember where he's coming from, he describes himself in Philippians as a Pharisee of Pharisees, as to the law blameless, he says.
He was top gun.
Yeah. Very committed, very conscientious, very sincere seeker after God in his own way. And the way that he had been trained in was the way of Phariseeism. And the Pharisees said, look at the law, study the law, know the law, understand the law, obey the law. So that's what Paul had devoted his life to doing.
And he was really the best of the best in doing that.
Right.
He knew the rules and he kept them.
Right. At least he knew the rules as those had been understood by Phariseeism and kept them in a manner that would be acceptable in the context of Phariseeism. What he came to learn in his life, however, is that that wasn't good enough. That to have achieved the level of moral perfection that Phariseeism would applaud, Paul recognized really wasn't good enough. And he describes in the book of Romans, he says at one point in Romans 7, when the commandment came, sin became alive and I died. When the commandment came, I died. And I think what he's describing there is, in his conscientious attempt to obey the law as he had been trained, he took it with utter seriousness, and he came across, as I would read what he's talking about in Romans 7, he came across the commandment in the Ten Commandments, you shall not covet, that is, don't even desire your neighbor's property, don't desire your neighbor's wife, don't desire your neighbor's possessions of in any form. And he recognized that while he could avoid adultery and theft, what he couldn't seem to be able to avoid were those seething desires within him that would logically lead to adultery and theft. Something inside of his own character, something inside of his own being, didn't immediately embrace the values that were embedded in God's laws. His own heart was out of sync with the values of God's kingdom and God's law.
So it sounds like the way it happened, Jack, is that he had this set of rules as they defined them back then, as the Pharisees defined them, who were the religious leaders of the day. And he was really following them as closely as he could, solemnly, seriously.
And I might add, thinking, therefore, that he was worthy of God, thinking that he was...
That made him worthy of being saved.
Right.
That he was good.
Right.
And God would accept him based on these good things that he was doing well.
In fact, to use the language he uses in Romans 7, that he was alive. And I think what he means by that is, I could picture myself standing at the judgment seat of God and God smiling down at me and saying, enter into life, good and faithful servant.
Well,
that was his self-concept.
I just imagine him standing up straight and tall and looking Jesus straight in the eye, or looking God straight in the eye and saying, yes, I did it, I'm great.
Right. Exactly.
This is good.
Exactly.
And feeling very, very proud and good about that.
Right.
And then, at some point in his life, it's like he stumbled onto something more profound than just adhering to behavioral rules. He came to understand that the commandment was not just talking about his actions on the outside, but his internal person.
Right.
And his internal person he found to be not good. He found that he did covet. He did want other people's stuff. He did want other people's wife. He wasn't able to stand straight and tall and say, aren't I good anymore? In fact, it sounds like he fell to his knees or fell to the ground and said, wow,
yeah.
I have discovered something now that's wipes out all that I used to think about myself.
Yeah, and that's what he means by, when the commandment came, I died. Now all of a sudden his self-concept plummets. Now he sees himself at the judgment seat and God saying, you're worthy of eternal condemnation. And Paul would say, yeah, I know. That's who I'm a despicable creature. I am a totally unworthy creature. So the commandment, what he means by the commandment came, I think, is exactly what you just described. As long as I have a relatively superficial understanding of what God requires of me, then I can afford to think pretty good of myself. But when I have a deep understanding of what requires of me, when I recognize that God doesn't want me to just act like a good person, God is requiring me to be a good person. On the inside, the person on the inside needs to be someone who kind of spontaneously and naturally and organically delights to do what's right and good and pure. And what Paul discovered is, I think, first, that that's really what God was requiring. And then when he recognized that that's really what God was requiring, his eyes were opened to all this seething perversity and selfishness and greed and pride and ugliness inside of himself. And that stuff that probably before he would have just dismissed as, well, that's just being human. I mean, that's just part of what it means to be a human being. But it's my virtue, it's my strength that I keep that inside and I never act on that.
Mm-hmm.
That was my own view of myself, mm-hmm, in my younger years as a Christian. Is there's a lot of garbage in me, but I thought, well, yeah, but I'm overcoming that garbage and I don't act on it, and I don't. Other people go and act out that garbage, but I don't act on it, and God must be really proud of me. But when it's you come to a point where you realize, but even having the garbage in there at all makes you unworthy of God, then all of a sudden the story is very different.
I was talking to a young person this weekend, and he was telling me that some friends of his were into pornography. And he was saying, I just can't understand why anybody would do that. It's just so awful, and that person is so bad that they're doing that. And I said to him, you mean to tell me that it's no temptation for you at all? That it's nothing that you would ever want to do? Oh, yeah, of course, it's a temptation. But I would never, ever do that kind of thing. I'm not like that. I'm not like those people.
Mm-hmm.
And that young person, I think, was really talking in the way that you're saying you did when you were young, and certainly that I did. And it's very hard for me to explain to that person, this young person, wait a minute, your heart isn't different. Because your actions are different on the outside, your heart's still full of sin. And God looks at that, not just the actions.
Yeah. One of the first passages that really got my attention was the parable that Jesus told about the tax gatherer and the Pharisee and the tax gatherer. The Pharisee goes to the temple and prays and lifts his eyes up to heaven and says, God, I thank you that I am not like other men. I'm not like this tax gatherer. And then he trots out a litany of his virtues. And then Jesus says the tax gatherer is so ashamed that he can't even lift his eyes up to heaven. He just bows his head and says, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. Then Jesus ends that parable saying, which of these will go out of the temple justified? It's the tax gatherer, not the Pharisee. And I can remember what struck me as I read that parable, and I couldn't figure out why Jesus said what he said. I couldn't figure out what was wrong with the Pharisee, because the Pharisee looked so much like me, that I could identify so much with the Pharisee. And what really struck me, I mean, on a superficial reading, if you don't pay attention to the details, and as I had done in years before, my thinking was that, well, the Pharisee's just kind of cocky and proud. He doesn't really realize who to give credit to his righteousness for. But as I have paid attention to the text, the Pharisee's prayer is, God, I thank you that I am not like other men. And then it finally dawned on me, the problem with the prayer is not that he wasn't giving God his due thanks. It wasn't that he was not sufficiently grateful. The problem was he didn't have a clue about the reality of who he was. He was saying, I'm not like other men. And the reality is he was exactly like other men. He just didn't know it. And that's when it struck me, that was the beginning of my growing self-awareness, that was true of me as well. I had spent most of my Christian youth thinking I was not like other men, and God was going to teach me that I was like other men.
And Jack now is a 40-something-year-old man, almost 50-year-old man.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right?
Yeah.
How do you see yourself?
Exactly like other men, as made of the same stuff. The way I put it when I first taught that passage is that I think I really had the perspective that all men were made of dust, but I was made of super dust. And now I realize there ain't no such thing as super dust. There's no human being on the face of the earth that is intrinsically any better off morally than anyone else. Some people are more civilized, have had more and better education, moral education and training, have been trained to believe in cultural values and social values and to be civilized and decent people. And they have acculturated themselves to that. They have made that a habit in their lives.
Like this young boy who said, I would never think about doing pornography. I just know that that's wrong. And I said, well, what about your lying? Well, lying's okay. It's not a good thing. It's a bad thing, but it's not nearly as bad as pornography. And I really think our culture would say that, Jack. Lying is better. And so it's also the culture coming in and speaking to us. And,
right, right.
Okay.
Yeah, just as it was in Paul's time. The whole school of thought of Phariseeism provided a context for him to have a self-image of himself as having arrived and
yes.
having made it, being yeah. okay. So you ask me as an almost 50-year-old, what do I think of myself today? I am made of the same stuff. Now, remember what we've said in the past weeks. God is sanctifying me. I believe that sincerely. And that has dramatically and markedly affected me at the level of my spirit, my heart. That is, the values that I'm committed to, the things I believe in, the values that I want to be inculcated into my very being by God. I probably am different from a lot of people in that regard. The non-believers in the world are not committed to the same value system. God has opened my eyes and opened my heart and given me desires for his kingdom, and not every human being shares that. But that's relatively superficial transformation compared to what I really need, what I really want, and what God is ultimately committed to giving me. At the level of my being, at the deepest level of my being, I'm capable of the most horrendous perversity and evil as anybody else is. And I'm convinced of that.
And that's what makes you not different than other men.
Exactly.
And that's what makes you, like in the parable, the tax gatherer who just bows before God and says that he's a sinner.
Right, right.
But I think I interrupted you before, and I want to make a point clear. Even as we say that we are all the same, I think a point you were making is, but sometimes we are more sophisticated or more educated in how to do things, to obey rules, to obey our culture's edicts about how we should act, and so we don't end up looking as bad as some people. Certainly the consequences of my actions for murdering somebody are much bigger than the consequences of my actions for lying. But nonetheless, that person who's murdered has broken the culture's rules and God's rules. But you're saying that our hearts are the same.
Right. Yeah. The same presumption and viciousness that would kill another person is at the root of me slandering a person. It's vicious, it's presumptuous, it's arrogant, it's proud, and all that seething, ugly mess inside that gives rise to all those evils.
I would say that perhaps the seething mess inside for someone who murders has just been wounded more, has just been hurt more, has just been gnawed at more. And had I been in a situation where my soul had been brutalized or gnawed at or abused, then I would definitely be a person who also murdered. I just happened to not have been in that environment where those kinds of things happen to me as severely.
Yeah. Yeah, if I grew up in a wonderfully secure home where my parents loved each other, they loved me, they gave me time, they gave me attention, they took care of me. I had tremendous advantages. What if I hadn't? You know, what if I had grown up in a home where my parents were split up, my parents didn't have any time for me, if anything, they got angry with me all the time and abused me and sent me all kinds of messages about what a piece of garbage I was. You know, imagine the kind of anger that would grow in me and the kind of warped sense of reality and the warped sense of priorities that I might grow up with. Well, now what is my sin going to look like? Sin is sin, but it's going to take on different faces and take on a different complexion based on my life experience and my training and the other input into my life, the other effects on my life. And we mustn't be fooled by that. We mustn't think because I had all the advantages to grow up to be a respectable person that I am therefore a good person. Being respectable in the world's eyes is not the same as being a good person as God sees good. And we have to have the eyes to see ourselves the way God sees us, not the way our neighbor sees us, not the way the people around us see us, but the way God sees us.
And to do that, we really have to be brutally honest with ourselves, especially if we look pretty good on the outside.
Yeah.
It's hard to be brutally honest with ourselves, and so what God certainly does in our lives is humble us, is bring us into situations where we really are faced with that. I was telling this young person again that I was talking to that I really liked that they, generally speaking, were civilized, that they didn't like pornography and were planning not to use it. But I said, I'd much prefer, I see a self-righteousness in you, thinking that you're better than. And I'd much prefer that you really stumble and come to an understanding of who you are, of your sinfulness, as opposed to you always doing it, quote, right, and never having an accurate perception of yourself. That scares me more, Jack.
Well, because it's dangerous. Because if we never come to realize my moral unworthiness, then we are never going to be seeking justification in God's eyes. If I'm already justified, why do I'm not in the market for any other means of justification, namely Jesus.
What you're saying, if I already think I'm good, then I'm going to come to Jesus as Paul did and just stand up straight and say, aren't I great?
Mm-hmm.
Rather than, like the tax gatherer in the parable, fall down at the feet of Jesus and say, I need you. I want you. And it's only in that context when I understand my need that I am justified.
Yeah.
That I am saved. That I do have God's blessing in my life.
Paul, before his conversion, he held the coats of the people who stoned Stephen. He thought that Christians who believed in this Jesus, who was such an embarrassment to the Jews, were despicable people that deserved to die, and he was engaged in a campaign to execute them, to literally stone them to death. because they were so embarrassing to him. Jesus and everyone who followed him was an embarrassment. Why were they an embarrassment? You know, believe in this person who all he did in life has managed to get himself crucified by the Romans. I mean, what a shameful embarrassment. He turned into somebody in time who called that person who got crucified by the Romans his Lord, and served him and obeyed him and considered him his hero. That's
his king.
His king, exactly. Well, what made the transformation? The transformation can be seen in the change in his self-concept. Before, when he thought he could stand before God on his own and with real confidence, upright, look God in the eyes and say, aren't I great? You know, what Jesus dying on the cross is completely irrelevant and completely meaningless to him. But when he came to a point of realizing, I am in deep trouble, I am worthy of nothing but being completely smashed by God, destroyed by God, annihilated by God, condemned eternally by God, and I don't have a chance of life. And then to recognize there's this man, Jesus, sent from God, who loved the world enough, loved Paul enough, to be willing to offer himself up as a propitiation, as an offering to God, as an appeal to God for mercy. Then all of a sudden, Paul says, yeah, Jesus, that's my only hope. I need that. That is an act of love. And I accept that and I will serve him forever.
You know, I really see God's love much, much bigger when I'm humbled and at his feet. And I see his grace bigger than I ever do looking at him, standing up straight and saying I'm good. Because then I don't see my great need for his love or his mercy or his grace, because I've already taken care of everything.
Right, exactly. Yeah, and the two go hand in hand. I just don't think you can separate the way we see Jesus and the way we see ourselves, the way we see God and the way we see ourselves. There's no way that we can be deluded and deceived about ourselves and see Jesus and God clearly for what they really are. We just can't do it. And that's why it's such an important and crucial part of our sanctification. What I was talking about, what got us off on our sidetrack, is Paul's own experience of being a good Pharisee who saw himself as worthy before God. So as a good Jew, he would see himself at the judgment seat before God and expect God to bless him with the blessing that he promised Abraham and the children of Abraham. He would expect that. But then he came to recognize, but wait, I'm not worthy of that. I'm worthy of condemnation instead. What Paul means by justification by works of the law, or what he means by works of the law, is that kind of lifestyle that he lived as a Pharisee, that project, life project that he took on as a Pharisee, to obey the law of God the way he and the other Pharisees had understood and defined obedience, so that they could stand before God and say, God, I am worthy of you. But what's fundamentally wrong with that, Paul comes to see, is that nobody could really ever obey the law to an extent and in that way that would truly make them worthy of God, because they just don't have it in themselves to do that. They are fundamentally bad people, not fundamentally good people, and the only sort of person who could really obey the law and then stand before God and say, God, I am worthy of you, is somebody who's fundamentally a good person. Because the requirements of the law involve, at their heart, the commandment to just be good, be a good person. And bad people can't be good persons.
So could we say that Jesus did the works of the law?
Yes, we could. Because I think that's true. Jesus is the only exception to not being able to be justified by the works of the law, because he was fundamentally and truly a good person and was not flawed like we are.
Okay, so I'm not sure I quite got it yet.
Okay.
And I'm wondering if I'm not quite getting it, if I'm just tired today, or and I am tired today, or if other people may not get it also, because it's not something that's talked about much. It's a distinction that I can't say that I'm really I'm not familiar with in this way. So try us again.
Okay. Well, what I'm saying is the crucial thing to see is that when Paul says we're justified by faith and not by works of the law, he's speaking into a particular context. He's speaking against a particular mindset. And for us to take the phrase, we're not justified by works of the law, and apply it anywhere and everywhere we want to, across the board, is not going to work. Because Paul has in mind the sort of understanding of being justified in God's eyes that he and his fellow Pharisees had in his time and his place. And lots of people throughout the history of the world have had the same mindset, but they have the same mindset in a different context. Not in the context of their Judaism and obedience to the Mosaic Law, but in a whole different context. But it
still would be works of the law, given their definition of the law in their milieu.
Yeah, or I would tend to put it another way. It is still a deadly mindset, even if they're not thinking about it the way Paul is, as obedience to the law of Moses. Even if they don't even know anything about the law of Moses, there is a deadly mindset that I can have. And what is that deadly mindset? That deadly mindset is, I'm fundamentally a good person. God would be proud of me.
Okay. That's the distinction that I don't think I was understanding. I was trying to think just about works of the law. How do we do works of the law? We don't do it exactly like that. We do it in the way that you and I were discussing, and I do understand well.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so that's how it fits with what the Bible's talking about.
Yeah, because see, in Romans, he calls them works of the law because he's a good Jew and has been trained in the tradition of Judaism. So part of what it means for him to be a good person and God would be proud of him is that he, you know, prays umpteen times a week, he fasts umpteen times a week, he gives his tithes, he pays his alms, he doesn't eat foods that are not kosher. He only eats kosher foods, so he keeps the dietary regulations. He keeps the Sabbath faithfully, and he's circumcised, on and on and on. All of those things in his mind contribute to his notion that, boy, I'm a good person. I'm worthy of God. Surely if anyone will receive the blessing of Abraham, I will receive the blessing of Abraham. Well, I didn't grow up keeping the Sabbath keeping dietary regulations and the festivals and all that kind of stuff. In fact, all that stuff seemed utterly irrelevant to me. But I had my own little set of values that I used to evaluate myself and come to the conclusion, Jack, you're really a good person. You're really doing well. Mm-hmm. Especially as you look around you at all the people that are not doing so well, you look really shining. And God would be proud of you. And if anyone is going to be accepted into the kingdom of heaven, it'll be you, Jack.
It is the mindset that I'm acceptable because I'm doing so well.
Precisely.
Regardless of the rules that I happen to be following, it's that I come to the conclusion that I'm doing really well.
Right.
And it is that that does not save us.
Yeah, that downright damns us. Because that kind of self-delusion, that kind of pride, self-righteousness, is completely antithetical to what's true and therefore to what a true child of God will see about themselves. If anything marks me off as a child of the devil, that does.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the only thing, but that's a big one. If I can't get a straight perception of myself as being really broken and fundamentally evil and fundamentally ugly inside, then I'm not seeing the truth about myself. And if I'm not seeing the truth about myself, I'm not being sanctified. I'm not being marked off as a child of God.
Okay.
So it's very important.
Very important. You know, something that's just come to mind about the process of what happens for me, and I don't know if that happens with other people. I imagine so, but I'll say it. Because often when I do, people say, yeah, that's it. That's what I've been doing. I really do understand, as I look at life, I understand life pretty well. I see things pretty clearly. I understand these concepts. But Jack, you can see my lack of understanding of the words of the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
I know this concept of not being, how do I put it briefly, that I'm not good, and that that's not what makes me acceptable to God. It's God's work on the cross that did that for me. But for me to read the words, works of the law, and to understand that that's what it means, I don't very well. And that's exactly why we're doing this unit on different words of the Bible and different concepts, so that people can really understand what the Bible is saying and make that fit into real life.
Right, exactly. Because otherwise the Bible remains a relatively unhelpful and closed book to us. At best, it doesn't help us understand anything, and at worst, it misleads us if we keep putting different content into these concepts and phrases than what were actually intended.
And this one is a very crucial one.
Yeah.
Because what I have done in my life in the past is thrown out any work. I can't say that I am doing that now, but if I'm saved by faith, then who is it? Martin Luther, who nailed that to the Wittenberg door and mm-hmm. said that we're just saved by faith and faith alone. Mm-hmm. I remember going to the Wittenberg door literally when I was in college and thinking, okay, I'm saved by faith and that's it. There's no works. There's nothing that anything else that needs to be a part of my life, but God saved me and that's how it is. It's done. And it's crucial to understand, as James says, how works and faith work together with each other. Now, we haven't gotten there yet.
Right.
But we're kind of trying to set the stage for that.
Right. One thing that I think is significant that we need to pay attention to is in Romans, he's arguing against non-believing, non-Christian Jews who are taking the attitude, Paul, you just have a terrible self-image, cut it out, just knuckle down, obey, do what good Pharisees are supposed to do, and that's all God can require, that's all God can expect. I mean, he's not going to be unrealistic, Paul. That would make you worthy in God's eyes. And Paul is responding to them saying, no, you've got it all wrong. You guys really don't understand this. There's not a single one of you out there who could ever be worthy of God. The law, the demands of the law are too exacting. They're too pure. They're too perfect. And you just can't measure up. Don't you see that you stand under condemnation? You're going to die. And the only possible way that you can be acceptable to God is if God just shows you mercy. If he just gives you justification in his eyes as a gift. Remind me sometime to define justification. But if he just grants you that as a gift. That's what he's doing in Romans. But then you go over to Galatians, and notice now he's arguing essentially the same thing, but now he's arguing that to so-called Christians, Jews who have believed that Jesus is the Messiah. And it's critical to see that, because we have a tendency, I think, in modern Christian culture to think, as long as I believe in Jesus, that's really all that's required of me. And so anyone who names the name of Jesus, and anyone who confesses Jesus, anyone who tells us they love Jesus, that's my brother, that's my sister. Well, that's not the attitude that Paul is taking in Galatians. He's saying to people, you call Jesus Lord, you say that Jesus is the Messiah, you believe that he's going to be the king of God's kingdom. Well, that's all well and good, but I'm really worried about you, because you don't have a clue about your own moral unworthiness. You're sitting here telling the Gentiles to come and keep the law in order to make themselves worthy of God, as if that were possible. If you are so self-deluded that you think that makes any sense, then I don't care how many times you confess Jesus as Lord in this day, you don't even know what that means. You don't even know what significance Jesus' death on the cross has. You don't know why his death was necessary, if you're so self-deluded that you think you can keep the law. So my point is, we have a tendency to kind of reduce our faith down to this simple little formula of believing in Jesus. And what we mean by believing in Jesus is just giving verbalization to the fact that I believe in Jesus. I'll say something about believing in Jesus, or I'll say I love him, or something like that. But it has to go much deeper than that. It has to go into the heart. It has to go into a whole mindset that understands who Jesus is, why he died on the cross, what significance that has in my life, why that's relevant to me personally. And when I understand that, then I can really say I believe in Jesus. Otherwise, it's just shallow, meaningless confession.
Well, I think there's like three layers that I'm seeing as you're talking that happened in my life and probably in most people's life. I start out with this believing in Jesus. Oh, I think that's true. I remember seeing a movie in Young Life or something in high school that showed all the prophecies and that Jesus must be the answer to those prophecies. And I thought, well, yeah, that just, it's like 2 + 2 = 4. That just makes sense. I believe in Jesus. I believe that he must have been God. He must have been real. Or else, the big saying at that time was either he was a lunatic or he was telling the truth. And I looked at it and I thought, well, he doesn't look like a lunatic, so he must be God. So that's just kind of the first layer of belief. The second one was, okay, now that I believe this, what do I need to be doing? And I started to do the works of the law. Mm-hmm. As we are describing them today, the works of the law for me were going to church every Sunday, praying, having devotions every morning, early before anything else, talking in a language that was kind of Christian-like, using Bible terms and those kinds of things. I did things like stop, you know, going to parties and drinking and, you know, that kind of thing where I was trying to clean up my life. The last layer.
And you patted yourself on the back for doing all that.
Major.
Yeah.
I was good. Yeah. Like Paul. Like the Pharisee. Mm-hmm. But I really believed it. And
sure.
Then I, like Paul, and I was alive then in my mind, I, like Paul, died. Because then I had to see with accuracy, really, the hatefulness in my heart, the self-righteousness in my heart, my pride, my arrogance. And then I had this much more accurate picture of myself. And it was at that point that I really understood my need for God. And at that point, I would say, I know that I am a Christian then. I may have been before, and God was just, you know, nurturing this tiny seed of faith that he had in me. The Holy Spirit was in me, working me toward this deeper understanding. But would you say that's probably true for most people? We work through those layers of belief.
Yeah, I can't imagine not having to go through something like that progression. Everyone I know has done so.
Everyone you know who is truly a believer.
Right, right.
And I think that's where it kind of marks us off. If I just stayed with the belief on the surface and continued in my self-righteousness, I don't know if there is any process that would mark me off as a believer then. It's without substance.
Right, right.
And our faith has to have substance, and I think that's part of what faith and works working together is talking about.
Yeah.
Your faith must have substance, not a surface one where you're just shining up your life and coming to the conclusion that you're good, but a substance that comes out of an accurate understanding of myself as a sinner.
Right. And it's a message that we really need to pay attention to in our day and age, and probably every day and age, but I really see it important in our day and age, because it's very possible to decide, of all the subcultures out there, which one do I want to belong to and hang around with? The Christians. There's a lot to be said for that. So we go join the Christian club, our local church, and we do Christian things, and we say Christian things, and we conform our life to a Christian lifestyle, and so on, without there being any real substantive transformation of my own perceptions, my own desires, what the Bible calls my heart and my spirit. Nothing really fundamentally changes at that level. And that's what you're describing, is that's a person who has become a Christian without any substantive change, without any content to his faith. That person will be damned. That all their Christianity is worthless. There's no salvation that comes from simply casting my lot with Christians. There needs to be a substantive change of my own heart, or I'm not being sanctified.
The staff of McKenzie Study Center has written a book on interpreting and understanding the Bible. It is what they call a common sense approach. They believe the Bible communicates God's wisdom to us in normal human language, and this requires us to be good readers. This also means we need to see each of the biblical authors as trying to communicate a particular set of ideas to a particular audience. But this is not always easy. In fact, it's hard work. What is needed is a set of godly principles to guide us in our interpretation. The authors of Biblical Interpretation, A Common Sense Approach, offer a reasonable guide to those principles. Call Mackenzie at 541-485-4801 to order your copy.
In these last few minutes, when we are thinking about wrapping up and talking about summarizing what we've said in the last hour, what comes to mind for me most, Jack, is something that's very personal to me. And that's that I feel pretty humbled in our talk today. I want to have known what the works of the law is. I've lived my life kind of acting like I knew things, and then I think through that I got the respect of other people because I just seemed kind of smart or kind of together. And it really is hard for me in front of you and in front of a whole radio audience to say, I really don't know what the works of the law is. I'm afraid that I've lost some of your respect.
Well, it's a very, very difficult interpretive question that has been debated by people who have spent a lot of time in Bible study, and it has eluded them, and it has escaped them. Some may even think that I'm pretty arrogant for thinking that I understand it. So you needn't be embarrassed. It's one of the more difficult theological questions that you confront in the New Testament, and a lot has to go into understanding exactly what Paul means there.
But I've really missed out on a lot by thinking I should know things and not asking the questions. And it feels really good to have asked them, and it feels really good that you aren't looking down on me right now. But I think it's really a hard cutting edge, for not only for myself, but for a lot of other people, to admit that we don't know and to allow ourselves to be learners and to ask questions.
Well, that's true, and that is one of the things that we really need to learn to do better at as a Christian culture, is to be a little bit more humble before the Bible, and instead of giving all kinds of glib answers and bumper sticker kind of definitions of theological terms, to really recognize the need to delve in more deeply and really truly understand what the apostles are teaching us and what they're getting at, and what realities that they're describing correspond to the realities in our own life. Only then do we really understand the New Testament, and we have perhaps been remiss as a culture in not pursuing that as far as we need to.
You have been listening to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center. If you would like a free copy of this program, or would like to know more about Mackenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College, you may call us at area code 541-485-4801. You can write to us at 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. And we're also on the Internet. Look for us under Mackenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College. If you didn't have time to write all that down, I'll repeat it again in just a moment. The Mackenzie staff has worked for years studying the Bible, understanding the world we live in, and pursuing what it means to be a Christian. They desire that their ministry may be valuable to others, but they also know that their efforts are in deep need of God's mercy. You can join the Mackenzie staff through classes, seminars, tapes, and papers. The Mackenzie Study Center is a nonprofit ministry entirely funded by the generous contributions of people who believe in its goals and have benefited from its ministry. If you would like to make a gift to Mackenzie, it will be entirely tax deductible. Just mail your check to Mackenzie Study Center, 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. If you would like to call and request a free taped copy of today's program, the telephone number is 541-485-4801. Now, on behalf of Dr. Jack Crabtree, Christine Barber, and the other staff of Mackenzie Study Center, thank you for listening.